arena of thanksgiving, where hundreds of people were feeling grateful together. Some were thankful a son or daughter did well and anticipated the new adventure of college ahead. For them, graduation was a growing up marker, a pause on the road toward the next thing, and they were offering appropriate thanks for a job well done. Others, however, seemed wildly grateful for this single moment as an all-out celebration for a goal achieved, the fruit of family sacrifice, the reward of a new life in a place of safety and success, the fulfillment of a dream. As I watched all these new Americans rejoice, my soul moved from discomfort to appreciation. I felt thankful for the school district and the teachers who made this miracle happen, for this good use of our taxes, and for the neighborhood that is home for all of us. As more and more graduates came forward, the crowd got louder and louder. Eventually, a kind of uninhibited thankfulness swept everyone, including our small family, into its chorus. When the last name was called, the graduates threw their caps in the air and released primal whoops of joy. Families jumped from their seats, shouting bravo and pumping fists into the air. People poured out of the exits, hugging one another, laughing and crying and taking pictures. Amid the thousands, a spontaneous litany emerged. "What a great day! We're so proud of you! Thank you, Jesus! Mom and Dad, thanks so much!" It was hard to find our daughter amid the grateful mob. But as I searched, I enjoyed winding through the crowd of my neighbors, from all social classes, from many races and nations, and eavesdropping on their thankfulness. I thought back to Saguaro, where a single clergy person gave a benediction, a prayer of blessing, as our graduation ended. We had waited for someone to lead us in gratitude. Here, there had been no religious professional to offer up our thanksgiving. Instead, we had done it ourselves. It was not particularly reverent, but it was fun. Gratitude is social. Strange thing about gratitude, it always comes with a preposition. We are grateful for something, grateful to someone, and often grateful with others. Even in untargeted gratitude, and when you are completely alone, prepositions show up. Imagine you need to get away, perhaps to struggle with a decision or a grief. During the winter, a friend loans you her beach house. It is the off-season, and you are alone. One morning, you wake up and walk at the water's edge. The sun is rising, colors shimmer off the waves, painting them shades of blue, pink, and silver, unlike any you have ever seen. All of a sudden, your heart opens up. You feel grateful for the beautiful sunrise, grateful to your friend, and grateful with the soaring seabirds. There are no other human beings, but you experience gratitude. And surprisingly enough, you also make community. In that moment, no matter how isolated the shore, gratitude connects you to nature's rhythms, to a distant friend, and to other creatures. The sun and sea offer their gifts, indiscriminately, as they always do, but you still say thanks to them, to your friend, perhaps to God. There, on a deserted beach, gifts are given and received, praise returned, and a new awareness of connection comes alive. When it comes to gratitude, me always leads to we. Gratitude takes us outside ourselves, insists Robert Emmons, where we see ourselves as part of a larger, intricate network of sustaining relationships, relationships that are mutually reciprocal. On November 22, 2015, Pastor Jason Michelli stood in the pulpit at Aldersgate United Methodist Church in Alexandria, Virginia, and preached a sermon on gratitude. It was right before Thanksgiving, and it was the church's stewardship season, a time when congregations are urged to consider gifts and generosity. In the autumn, a gratitude sermon was nothing out of the ordinary. But this was not an ordinary day. Jason, a 40-something father with young children, was preaching for the first time in nearly a year, since being diagnosed with and treated for a rare and incurable form of cancer. He was better, and the cancer was controlled. But as the congregation knew, he would have to do chemo every 2 months for the rest of his life. He stood in the pulpit, barely out of treatment, to preach a Thanksgiving sermon for his community. He began, "You all have done so much for us. You've fed us and prayed for us and with us. You've helped us with my medical bills, and you've sat with me in the hospital. You were there to catch me when I passed out in the chemo room, and you didn't bat an eye when I puked in your car." But he said, as much as he appreciated it, he actually hated all that help. "I've always been awful at receiving gifts," he admitted. "I hate feeling like I'm in another's debt. I was a guy who kept score, which means I didn't mind you being in my debt. I just didn't want to be in yours." But he learned something. Gratitude is not about repayment of debts. It is about relationships. Through his cancer, Jason discovered that courage and hope could not be summoned magically. Rather, strength and healing came through community. He spoke of the church's greatest gift to his family in crisis. "We can endure all things because you've been with us. You're with us. More so than all the stuff you've done for us, you've been with us." With no dry eye in the congregation, he continued, "It was kind of you to share my nightmare. It was kind of you to share in my pain and suffering. It was kind of you to share in Allie's worry, in my boy's fears and anxiety. It was kind of you to make my cancer, our cancer, yours too. Thank you," he finished, "for being with me." Gratitude is social. It is about, as Pastor Jason learned, presence, participation, and partnership. It is about being with one another, in life together. It is the thread of nature and neighbor, the seemingly fragile strands of gifts and goodness that weave our lives together. Breaking down walls. A few months after a white supremacist walked into Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, and killed 9 people, I stood outside the building at the makeshift memorial to the victims. As I stared at the flowers and letters marking this sad and sacred place, contemplating the legacy of slavery and the evil of racism, I caught sight of 2 African-American men at the periphery. With flowers in hand, they were waiting to approach the wall. I stepped aside to make way for them. After a few minutes of quiet reflection, the men attempted to take a selfie in front of the church. They were not very good at it. "Would you like me to take your picture?" I asked. "Yes, please," one responded as he handed me his cell phone. I snapped their picture, making sure that the photos had turned out well. I had done so with a reverence I hoped was appropriate to the moment. I held out the phone to return it to its owner, but not before he said, "We came a long way to be here. Thank you so much." I replied, "I'm so sorry. It is the least I can do. It was awful, just... I'm so sorry. My voice broke a little. Instead of reaching for the phone, the man reached toward me and gave me a hug. One of those side-by-side hugs sometimes offered by strangers. Together, we stood at the wall in a companionable silence that seemed to mix grief and gratitude. For a moment, another sort of wall, the wall of human division, at least cracked and let grace through. He turned, as did his friend. They both shook my hand, and we parted ways. I felt grateful to have been there, grateful for their presence. The hugs and their willingness to share their silence seemed like a gift. Although we feel grateful as individuals and can develop spiritual and ethical practices of gratitude in our personal lives, the deepest experiences of gratitude move us beyond islands of isolation into connection and community. Feeling grateful causes us to reach out toward its perceived source. Gratitude only happens when we get a real gift, one ethicist says. And a real gift comes with a giver attached. In the case of the sunrise, it might mean lifting our hands in praise to the sky or to God. In the case of another person, it typically means expressing thanks through a hug. Indeed, hugging is perceived as one of the most central and positive features of gratitude. We literally want to embrace the giver. Reaching beyond ourselves comes naturally when we are grateful. Gratitude can trigger the need for physical contact, writes one research team. They continue, the opposite also seems to be true. Being hugged can trigger feelings of gratitude. In their work, they demonstrated that friendly and non-competitive touch fostered warmth and relationship, and thereby increased experiences of gratitude. Although people who did not touch felt grateful after a favor was done, people who were touched felt grateful both before and after a gift was introduced in the relationship. Touch alone raised feelings of gratitude. A touch, when combined with a gift, elevated feelings of gratitude even more. Hugs and touching are a result of gratitude, and increased gratitude is a result of hugs and touching. We discovered, concluded the study authors, that a friendly touch can promote gratitude and communal relations concurrently. Without touch, we can still feel grateful. But those feelings are more circumscribed than when accompanied by physical expressions of care in the friendship and community of others. In Western societies, more people than ever live alone. In some European and North American cities, the number of single-person households nears 60%, and social isolation tripled in the first years of the 21st century. Although living solo is not necessarily a problem, as it points toward new patterns of potential community and the need to forge new connections, it also suggests that many people are not physically touched in friendly ways on a regular basis. Solo living, along with new forms of relationships through technology, have conspired to erode touch like hugging. Many observers argue that our societies are awash with a loneliness epidemic, making it increasingly difficult to address a variety of collective problems, from aging to economic inequality to climate change. Has social isolation also created an erosion of public gratitude? Although gratitude has had a bit of a revival in recent years, the longer view is helpful. Use of the words gratitude and thanksgiving reached a peak around 1820 and steadily declined to a low around 2000, with similar patterns for grateful and thankful. Language use reveals that we are not nearly as aware of gratitude as our ancestors were. Not to wax nostalgic about it, but most 19th century people lived in cultures with thicker social ties. Although there were fewer people, most resided in communities of daily physical interaction. Even with strict codes of manners and conventions like wearing gloves, I suspect people touched more in friendly, if reserved, ways. Gratitude was more readily a part of their world. Beginning around 2000, however, something else began to occur. We started using the word gratitude again. Not nearly as much as in the past, but there was an uptick of use nevertheless. Are we reaching out to reclaim gratitude because we are reaching toward one another again? But where? Where in the world can we find each other in the midst of a lonely world? Can we feel grateful together? Grateful goes viral. On January 12, 2017, just days before leaving the White House, President Barack Obama surprised Vice President Joseph Biden by awarding him the Presidential Medal of Freedom with distinction. After citing specific personal and political accomplishments, the president concluded, "A grateful nation thanks Vice President Joseph R. Biden Jr. for his lifetime of service on behalf of the United States of America." As the president placed the medal around his neck, Biden closed his eyes as if in prayer, tears welling up, and then turned around and embraced Obama. He reached out to family and friends with hugs and kisses. Overcome with emotion, Biden stepped to the microphone and said, "This honor is far beyond what I deserve." He insisted that the award was merely a reflection of President Obama's generosity. There was not a dry eye in the room, or my living room, or, as it happened, on Facebook or Twitter. For the next 2 days, the video of the event went viral, spinning off hundreds of articles and memes, all shared and shared again. Obama joked about their bromance, while CNN referred to the award ceremony as the best surprise party ever and the ultimate promposal. At heart, however, it was an unexpected, deeply felt thank you party, and we were all invited via television and the internet. More than half of my Facebook friends shared it, I actually tried to count, and most said that it made them cry. A few said they were so distraught by the election results that they could not watch, it made them too sad. But the oddest thing about the whole event was that it was intimate and public at the same time. Watching two men express their mutual gratitude and appreciation for each other, and seeing the power of gratefulness to surprise and overwhelm, moved millions who were not there to feel connected to these men, as if they too were saying thank you. Rabbi Shai Held called it the week that Obama and Biden cried. He praised both men for displaying the sort of vulnerability that draws us together as human beings. "I am grateful to live at a time when a man, the most powerful man in the world, no less, can model what it means to let life affect him to the point where tears come." A Guardian columnist opined, "Every time these political powerhouses become misty-eyed, they send the message that having human feelings doesn't equal incompetence. Human emotions like deep gratitude are the opposite of incompetence. They prove the power to connect through the heart. It is not the power of an office, role, or title. Rather, it is the power of being with others, even millions of others, through the binding and beautiful experience of appreciation. The ecstasy of gratitude. Gratitude is powerful. Theologian Louis Schmieds recalls how he felt when he realized that he had survived a life-threatening illness. "I was seized with a frenzy of gratitude, possessed. My arms rose straight up by themselves. 100-pound weight could not have held them at my side. My hands open, my fingers spread, waving, twisting, while I blessed the Lord for the almost unbearable goodness of being alive on this good earth, in this good body, at this present time. I was flying outside of myself, high, held in weightless lightness, as if my earthly existence needed no ground to rest in, but was hung in space with only love to keep it aloft. It was then I learned that gratitude is the best feeling I would ever have, the ultimate joy of living." As I read Smead's account, I realized that I sat up straighter, stretched my arms wide, and took a great cleansing breath. Without intending it, I imitated him. His act of gratitude inspired me to physically move as he had moved and to empathetically feel grateful. He referred to the moment as a frenzy, but it was clearly a frenzy of wholeness and goodness, pure joy. In his book on happiness, social psychologist Jonathan Haidt quotes Thomas Jefferson, who actually speculated on the communal and imitative nature of beneficial emotions. "When any act of charity or of gratitude, for instance, is presented to our sight or imagination, we are deeply impressed with its beauty and feel a strong desire in ourselves of doing charitable and grateful acts also." Inspired by this Jeffersonian clue, Haidt and his researchers went on to find evidence that people really do respond emotionally to acts of moral beauty, and that beneficial acts and feelings cause others to want to copy them. Haidt refers to this as moral elevation, and his team demonstrated that witnessing goodness actually increased biological responses in the parasympathetic nervous system, which controls heart rate and calm breathing. Indeed, gratitude research has pointed to this same effect. Gratitude, evidently, is contagious. It can be spread from heart to heart. Haidt argues that elevation is generally a calming response, not the frenzy of gratitude reported by Louis Schmieds. But he also points out that there is a related impulse, awe, or the emotion of self-transcendence. Awe is also a dimension of gratitude. Pioneering psychologist Abraham Maslow identified moments like the one Schmieds describes as peak experiences, where the universe is perceived as a unified whole, and the person is flooded with feelings of wonder, awe, joy, love, and gratitude. As a result, one feels more integrated, happy, and in harmony with the self and the world. This is the territory of frenzy or ecstasy, and such experiences are also sought and imitated by others, most often through religion and spiritual practices. Haidt studied elevation, and Maslow studied peak experiences in individuals. But if gratitude elevates and is related to all, might not its imitative power be expanded beyond individuals to communities? Indeed, some social scientists have suggested that there exist resonance patterns, whereby people find harmony and group nobility through imitation, especially in ritual and liturgy. In this state, I passes unconsciously into a we. My becomes our. There are some fine distinctions here. For example, at many sporting events, there is a moment of appreciation for wounded veterans in the form of recognition, applause, and a song. This creates a feeling of patriotism, which at its best is a form of social gratitude. This act of communal thanks inspires not only good feelings toward soldier and nation, it opens the potential to imitate selflessness, noble good, and heroism. Patriotic displays can and do result in strong emotional responses, even peak experiences for some people. Given the nature of gratitude for one's country, that should be expected. Healthy gratitude for one's homeland, however, is not exclusive. If you are grateful for your nation, you understand that others are equally grateful for theirs. Genuine gratitude opens the heart to appreciate that people from other places feel the same. When patriotism, the kind of gratitude that links people in a common quest for the noble good, mutates into nationalism, however, it becomes a problem. In nationalism, gratitude is the exclusive right of only some people, us, over everyone else. It maintains that only we can be grateful because our nation is the best one, and all other people are misguided when they appreciate the second-rate places where they were born. Nationalism is not about gratitude. It is about dominance. What is good cannot be shared beyond the in-group, and everyone else becomes an enemy. There is a difference between shedding a few tears during the national anthem at a baseball game and going along with a crowd at a fascist rally. Ultimately, gratitude is an aspect of empathy. To empathize means to feel into, or with another, to understand and be with others emotionally. If you are thankful for something that cuts you off from others or sets people at odds, it may not be genuine gratitude. It may be an emotion birthed in fear or control. Gratitude connects us, even across racial, class, and national boundaries, allowing us to feel together. We reach out toward one another. We are elevated toward doing good. We might share the frenzy of gratefulness. We might find ourselves serving others or dancing in the streets. Communal emotions are powerful. This can be frightening, and perhaps that is why we shy away from shared emotional experiences, because some feelings can cause riots, mob violence, or nationalist fervors. But there is a Sanskrit word that helps describe the positive sense of gratitude as a communal emotion. Kama Mutta, moved by love. When we are touched deeply by others, when we feel deeply with others, we experience the oneness of love, belonging, or union with an individual person, a family, a team, a nation, nature, the cosmos, God. Profound experiences of gifts and thanks often bring forth tears, causing people to feel deeply together, even those who only witness acts of gratitude. We can recognize that we humans are communal creatures, that we can imitate one another and inspire each other toward grace and gratitude for the good of all. Like celebrating the achievement of young adults, crying with a sick pastor and his family, standing in solidarity with grieving strangers, or appreciating the friendship of two public leaders. We can feel hope and goodness together, and that should shape us in community. gratitude, empathy, kama mutta. Chapter 6. Thankful and Festive. As we travel with gratitude and share that feeling, like a ripple, it spreads across the world. Larry Voskin. When I lost my job at the college, I fell into a terrible funk. I did not know what to do with myself, and I had lost friends and colleagues in the midst of it all. Not only had my job disappeared, so had much of my community. Being fired is a bit like being voted off the island or being sent into exile. "You need to get out more," a friend suggested. "What should I do?" I replied. I really did not know. For years, my life had revolved around religion and academics. In the wake of leaving the college, the academic calendar no longer patterned my life. Church was good, my new congregation was welcoming, and I was learning things there and making friends. But being freed from the constraints of evangelical expectations was disconcerting for me. Until my early 30s, my social life was shaped mostly by friendships with other evangelical Christians. I realized that I did not really know many people outside that community, and now they had essentially abandoned me. I had no idea what secular people did for fun. I was sheltered. Well, more like bunkered. "Why not go with me to the wine festival?" she suggested. "You like good wine. You'll love it, I promise." I timidly agreed. The festival was a fundraiser for a local museum, held every year in a grove of live oak and eucalyptus trees. It was, as might be expected, a glorious Santa Barbara day, sunny and warm. Local wineries set up tables and poured generous tastings, and laughter got louder and more raucous with every glass. Strangers mingled and swayed together to the sounds of jazz. For an afternoon, I forgot about the college and everything that had happened there. I met new people, talked about food and wine, and listened to music. People were happy and not obsessed with doctrinal purity or evangelizing the world. Maybe it was the wine, but the day was light and bright and joyful. I really did not know one could enjoy life outside a church. It was everything that my stern evangelical friends warned about, the temptations of Dionysian pleasures. The mystical poet Rumi once said, "Gratitude is the wine of the soul." Whatever the truth of that, I know a wine festival pointed me toward new paths of gratitude. It was not, of course, just the wine. It was the festivity itself of gathering with strangers and sharing food, the sunlight, and enjoying life. I discovered that I lived in a city of festivals, of food and wine and music and theater and art, of cultures and history, of gardens and architecture and good causes. Sure, the weather was beautiful, but the people there seemed to take a particular pleasure in street fairs, parades, and all sorts of public displays of conviviality. Once I was simply walking by a bookstore, and some street musicians began to play. People who had been strolling by stopped, listened, and started to dance on the sidewalk. Some ancient spirit of eternal festivity inhabited the place, as if the Chumash shamans continued to bless with song and dance, placing a permanent rainbow of joy across the California sky. I had lost my job and gotten divorced, but Santa Barbara renewed my soul. The city's civic-hearted playfulness actually took me back to times in my childhood when I had experienced similar feelings of communal joy. A neighborhood Easter parade, dancing around the maypole, a community 4th of July picnic, a Halloween street party, harvest festivals, caroling on Main Street with friends. Back when my life was not prescribed by doctrine or piety, Some of the happiest times I had known happened with strangers and friends in the streets. When my friend invited me to the wine festival that day, I rediscovered communal playfulness. I remembered that festivity is central to joy. Take thanks to the streets. Certainly we think of such gatherings, graduations, weddings, street fairs and festivals, and harvest celebrations, as expressions of happiness. They are also expressions of a very particular kind of gratitude, the public exuberance of thanks, often in response to rites of passage or seasons of life. Graduation is a public ritual of gratitude for a child growing up and entering adult life. Weddings give thanks for a marriage and the beginning of a new family. Food and wine festivals originated to mark spring planting or the fall gathering in of the crop. In a real sense, the streets are the theaters of giving thanks. As long as humans have existed, there have been such festivals. Having seen too many Hollywood films, we might easily think of these gatherings as little more than drunken orgies, like the scene in the Ten Commandments in which the Hebrew people reject their God to worship a golden calf instead. Although there were such wild communal events, most festivals were actually based in religious belief and celebrated the gifts of the gods toward a tribe or nation. These were festivals of gratitude, not just bacchanalia. And public celebrations of Thanksgiving are an important part of the biblical story shared by Jews, Christians, and Muslims. Professor Walter Brueggemann explains that the three great Jewish festivals of the Hebrew Bible, Passover, Pentecost, and Booths, formed a liturgical triad of celebrating God's gifts of freedom and abundance. In ancient Israel, Jews traveled to Jerusalem for each festival, leaving behind the work and responsibilities of home and village. This physical separation created an alternate space for celebration, a place at which they could arrive, as the scripture instructs, empty-handed, so that God might fill their hands with gifts. The festivals are designed as outpourings of gratitude by Israel, insists Brueggemann, who lives completely by the power and generosity of Yahweh, the Hebrew name for God. Indeed, the gatherings were intended to produce the emotions of humility, joy, and gratefulness to remind the Israelites that their community was grounded in generosity and gratitude, completely dependent upon the gifts of a good God. Of course, many cultures held such festivals of gratitude. The ones of ancient Israel are particularly interesting, though. In other nations, people gathered to give their gods gifts in order that the gods might respond with gratitude to the people's praise and send them rain, an abundant harvest, or a military victory. In Israel, gratitude worked differently. God sent gifts to the people, and the people responded in gratitude with promises to live more deeply in love and the law. Israel reversed the structure of gifts and gratitude. In the festivals, Brueggemann says, Israel comes to a fresh realization that its freedom is not its own work, but is a gift gladly given by Yahweh. Festival is the capacity to enter a way of life in which all other claims, pressures, and realities can be suspended. In short, the festivals, the great communal celebrations of gratitude, modeled an alternative community, one based in abundance and joy. Festivals are a microcosm of how life should be. In our time and place, finishes Brueggemann, it is a wonderment if festival can have such power and attractiveness, given pervasive complacency, self-indulgence, and individual autonomy. I do not really wonder, for I found it to be true in the streets of Santa Barbara. Games and gratitude. During the autumn of 2016, baseball fans watched with a sense of astonishment as the Chicago Cubs won the World Series. Even if you were not a Cubs fan, it was hard not to appreciate the sheer magnitude of sports history that unfolded in seven nail-biting games. After 108 years of losing, the Cubs broke the fabled curse of the Billy Goat, beat the Cleveland Indians, and reigned as baseball's champions. The final game of the series was not played in Chicago, but in Cleveland. Thousands of Cubs fans gathered outside of Chicago's Wrigley Field to share the game together. With the final out, the stadium's scoreboard lit up, "Cubs win!" Fireworks above the park turned the night into blazing joy. Thousands of fans who gathered outside the park sang, hugged, cheered, kissed, and cried. "Grown men and women wept," reported the Chicago Tribune. Fireworks lit up the sky in both the city and suburbs, while school-aged children gathered on sidewalks long after bedtime to cheer honking cars. This is what it looks like when a 108-year-old dream is finally realized. People took to the streets with a celebration three generations in the making. "It was," said one young fan on behalf of myriad others, "the greatest night of my life." 2 days later, the team joined their fans on the streets. The city hosted a parade and rally in Grant Park, and the jubilation continued, with as many as 5 million people lining streets and showing up at the event. A local television station reported, "Cubs World Series celebration ranks as the seventh largest gathering in human history," positioning the Chicago Victory Party between the Pope's 2015 visit to the Philippines and the 1970 funeral of Egypt's President Nasser in historic magnitude. The more restrained Chicago Tribune also said that the crowds were large, but that the numbers may have been exaggerated due to runaway enthusiasm. In the months following the victory, there were fewer people dancing in Chicago streets, but enthusiasm did not abate. The celebrations gave way to another form of communal bonding, gratitude. As the Washington Post reported, "The Cubs players and staff have grown accustomed to a strange phenomenon. Everywhere they go, people come up to them with stories of a late father, a grandfather, a mother, a grandmother, a brother, or a sister who was the biggest Cubs fan of them all. The World Series title would have meant so much to them." Almost uniformly, the interaction ends with two words: "Thank you." "It's a lot of gratitude," says Cubs manager Joe Madden. "It's the same refrain from everybody. For the most part, they don't want an autograph or a picture. They just want to shake your hand and say thank you." Sports and gratitude do not often show up in the same sentence. When we think of raucous emotions at a sporting event, rowdy crowds perhaps coming close to a riot, and on occasion, violence come to mind. The emotions let loose during games seem birthed in the strivings of competition, unrelated to the genteel strains of Thanksgiving. But sports and communal emotion go together. "For most people in the world today," claims journalist Barbara Ehrenreich, "the experience of collective ecstasy is likely to be found, if it is found at all, not in a church or at a concert or rally, but at a sports event." Yet ecstasy depends on relief and release. In giant stadiums, relief and release can be the result of beer sales. But relief and release come from other sources as well. Relief from no longer being losers, release from the curse that haunted a team. Relief and release are tied to appreciation for a lucky break, the stars aligning, the talent and grit of the players. And not just for fans, but for players as well. A pitcher who cannot seem to put away an inning and might lose the game suddenly focuses and strikes out three batters. As he walks off the field, he looks to the heavens and says, "Thank you." The crowd cheers their appreciation. A tennis player behind in her set rallies for the win. As she scores the final point, she falls to her knees with gratitude, and spectators breathe that moment of thanksgiving with her. The communal experience of sports is often linked to gratitude, a festal ecstasy that is part beer and part praise. Thanksgiving and sports have often mixed. No doubt those ancient Israelites kicked around a few balls while they waited their turn to sacrifice lambs in thanks to Yahweh at the temple in Jerusalem. In America, the first Thanksgiving football game was played on November 30th, 1873, when Princeton and Yale faced one another in Hoboken, New Jersey. The whole thing proved such a huge success that the schools moved the Thanksgiving game to New York City, where, in a single decade, attendance grew from 5 to an astonishing 40,000 fans, leading reporters to claim that it was the greatest sporting event this country has to show. The Princeton-Yale game was accompanied by a massive parade on Broadway, complete with tailgating, albeit in horse-drawn carriages, and inebriated students. Thus, the original New York Thanksgiving Day Parade was not a commercial celebration of department store fame that would come later in 1924. Rather, New York's first such parade offered harvest thanks and celebrated pigskin. In a recent academic study, Professor Lung Hung Cheng discovered that athletes with a strong sense of gratitude had a higher sense of personal well-being and team satisfaction. Grateful athletes are more satisfied with their team and overall lives. The more thankful a player is for training, mentors, and other players, the more supported and successful the player feels. This support, in turn, builds persistence and confidence and connects individual players to a community of teammates. Grateful people play together better. That, of course, is the real point. Sports can be serious business, yes, real business, the money-making kind. It can also be a competition, and it can be worship. At its core, however, sport is organized play, a game. And it turns out that play and gratitude are linked. Mary Beth Sammons, co-author of The Grateful Life, recalls how she struggled as her father and mother passed away. Not quickly, but over 6 long years of illness and multiple hospitalizations. At the same time, she was also helping to raise her 3-year-old granddaughter. She unexpectedly discovered that playing with a toddler opened the door to healing gratitude. Play opened the path from brokenness to the search for light in every corner of every moment I was experiencing. She remembers. It helped me tap into a new level of consciousness. Play unplugged my fear, letting me shed tears of sorrow and joy, and gave me hope and reverence for the precious moments spent at my parents' sides. And how did this help her toward gratefulness? By providing physical relief from the weariness of hospital routine, by releasing her to remember her parents' rich lives, and by opening up new ways of connecting with them and their memory. She writes of playing with her grandchild. Play shifted my lens. It filled me with memories of my childhood and spending times just like this with both my parents, who introduced me to the sheer pleasure of holding a good book and entering a new world through its pages. I was grateful for parents who let me gather my friends and build a treehouse in our backyard. I remembered with thankfulness my mom driving me and my friends to the skating rink, where most winters we practically lived all day, racing around the track and sipping hot chocolate. Through play, I could let go with love of the fact that my parents would no longer physically be a part of my life. But I learned that they would live on in the books they had taught me to love, and in the spirit of playfulness. Play is sports, and play is festivity. Although not completely impossible to do, we generally do not play alone. Even if no team is around, we might play with a dog, with a toddler, with another friend. But play does not isolate. We play together. And play leads us to a different place. After the stressful American election in 2016 and the first months of the Trump presidency, my husband looked at me over dinner one night and said, "I can't wait for baseball season. Baseball is pretty much the only thing that can help right now." We live in Washington, D.C., where politics is always in your face, where national news is local news. There is no escape. Except through our sports teams, like the Washington Nationals. My husband is a fanatical fan, one who lives in a mixture of gratitude and eternal hope. Baseball is not a distraction. It is more of a religion. It saves him. He does not just watch games. Rather, he plays them with his team. True sports fans are never merely spectators. They participate. They breathe and live with and for the game. Professor Joseph Price, who has written on the Super Bowl, sees play as a spiritual experience. It's possible to take play seriously, and it's possible for faith to be an act of play. And play is an exercise, basically, of the spirit. Watch children in a playground at a park, their spirits soar. And isn't that what we aspire to cultivate in faith communities? To have the adults' spirits soar. Perhaps we need elements of play in worship, in sport. Play is an exercise basically of the spirit, on the playground and in the stands. If that is a roadmap for faith communities, then it is also a life-giving way beyond the walls of church or synagogue. Public playfulness and public thanksgiving go hand in glove. Sports are so much more than winning. Our stadiums, or perhaps local bars where people who cannot afford expensive tickets gather to cheer on a beloved team, might well be our most public arenas of gratitude. When we play, when we cheer on our team, we are performing thanks. Games and gratitude go together. The Eucharist. Another communal place where imbibing and praise come together in gratitude is in church, in a ritual celebration called the Eucharist, where people share bread and wine with each other. Of course, wine combined with religion is nothing new. Since the beginning of human history, frenzied worshipers have poured out libations before their gods, often in great festivals resembling spiritual orgies. In these celebrations, people celebrated wine and harvest as they sang, played, and danced in the streets, hoping such ecstasy would please the gods and remind them to send food and wine next year, too. Ancient Romans were good at it. When word got out that Christians held feasts of bread and wine, their pagan neighbors were not shocked. What the Romans found surprising was that the Christians did it in secret, leading their critics to wonder if the Jesus festival was so lurid that Christians had to do it behind closed doors. Surely, they thought, whatever Eucharist was, it must be immoral. Eucharist is the word that Episcopalians, Catholics, Orthodox Christians, some Lutherans, and some Presbyterians used to refer to the meal others call the Lord's Supper or Communion. It is the central ritual of Christian community, considered the most sacred moment of Sunday worship. Participants eat bread and drink wine in what most call a sacrament to reenact the final meal Jesus shared with his disciples on the night before he died. The word Eucharist is from the Greek Eucharistia, meaning thanksgiving or gratitude. It is a compound term derived from the Greek words ou for well and charis for favor or grace. Thus, Eucharist, that is gratitude, means well-favored or good grace. Bread is blessed and shared, a reminder that food is a gift from God, a gift that gives life to our bodies. Wine is blessed and shared, a reminder that drink is a gift from God, a gift that gives joy to our souls. God gives good gifts of favor and grace. The people receive and respond with promises of faithfulness and thanksgiving. The Eucharist does not really resemble pagan harvest celebrations. There, the emphasis is on pleasing the gods and imploring them to send more bread and wine next year. Rather, the Christian celebration echoes those ancient Hebrew festivals in which the Jews recognized and received God's gifts of abundance and, with humility, returned gratefulness. No need to please or plead, for God's gift is all of creation, and these gifts surround all people through all time. God does not need to be convinced to give or begged to send a favor. But human beings need to be reminded that abundance is the nature of existence. The Jews went to Jerusalem 2 or 3 times a year to remember this and give thanks for it. Christians go to their congregations weekly or monthly to do the same. To feast upon, that is, have a festival of, gratefulness. The Jewish and Christian settings are different, but the biblical story of abundance and thanks is pretty much the same. That is what church is intended to be, a festive community dependent on gifts of abundance. Everything is a gift. Bread is a gift, wine is a gift, life and joy are gifts. No one can ever pay them back. God never withholds. All we can do is receive. In awe of such favor and grace, say thank you to the giver, and then pay it forward with humble service to others. Just like the Jews. But for Christians, the story is mediated through Jesus. Eucharist, gratitude, thanksgiving. On occasion, I have heard Christians speak of taking the Eucharist. Oh, someone might say, I haven't been to church for a while. I need to go and take the Eucharist. This colloquialism comes from Jesus' words reported in the Gospel of Matthew. While they were eating, Jesus took a loaf of bread, and after blessing it, he broke it, gave it to the disciples, and said, Take, eat, this is my body. So, people take the bread. But how do you take a gift? One definition of take is a synonym for steal. For example, when we take something illegally or stealthily, something not belonging to or intended for us. Or maybe we take something so someone else cannot. If we take something, we make it ours. We own it. Taking is so wrapped up with status, power, and privilege, with notions of entitlement in economics, that it just does not seem to relate abundance and gratefulness. Interestingly enough, the Greek word is labete, which is translated to take, but also means to receive. When Jesus handed bread to his friends, he said, receive, feast, receive, not take. To receive gifts and to give thanks is the story of faith. To shift the word removes any connotation of economic exchange and ownership and reaffirms that the Eucharist is a free gift. Grace and favor are for all, to all, and with the whole world. Receiving, not taking, is the very meaning of our shared humanity, and it is the thread of community. At the center of Christian experience is a gift of abundance. Jesus actually referred to it as abundant life in John 10:10, that is received with humility and calls a people to respond with gratitude and faithfulness. Thus, giving thanks is the primary communal emotion of Christianity.